When you watch a natural disaster unfold, say a massive hurricane hitting a coastline or a catastrophic flood, there is just this absolute terror in that moment.
Oh, absolutely. It's visceral.
Right. It's deeply unsettling. But if you take a step back, there is also a certain inherent logic to it. It's just physics.
Yeah, cause and effect.
Exactly. It's the natural world operating under the laws of thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Like the atmospheric pressure drops, the warm water fuels the storm, the surge rises, and, well, the damage happens.
You don't have to like it, but you can understand it.
Yeah, it's horrific, but your brain can process the mechanics of it. But then, and I know you felt this, you pull out your phone,
Right.
you open up whatever news app you use, or you turn on the evening broadcast, and you look at global conflict. You see these endless grinding wars.
The cycles of retaliation that just span decades.
Decades. You see entire populations displaced, infrastructure turned to ash, and what the experts call structural violence. And suddenly, looking at that screen, it just doesn't feel like physics anymore.
No, not at all.
It doesn't feel like an inevitable law of nature. It feels like a massive, incredibly complex, entirely human-built machine.
Yes, a machine we built ourselves.
Right. But somehow, looking at the wreckage, it feels like we've completely lost the instruction manual for it. You just sit there on your couch, watching the chaos day after day, and you just want to understand the world without, drowning in the sheer, overwhelming tragedy of the news cycle.
It's exhausting. It really is.
It is. And if you've ever felt that way, that specific brand of exhausted confusion, I really want you to know that you are not alone. That exact feeling is why we are here today.
It is a profoundly disorienting feeling, and I'd argue it's a very modern one, too.
How so?
Well, we naturally look for a simple cause and effect relationship, like we have in the natural world, like you were saying. We want to say event A caused conflict B.
Right. We want a simple narrative.
Exactly. But human systems, especially systems of state violence and global conflict, they just don't operate on simple physics.
They're way messier.
So much messier. They are built on deeply sedimented layers of history, psychological intention, and these hidden institutional structures that most of us just never get to see.
That is the perfect way to frame it. And honestly, that brings us to the core mission of today's deep dive.
Yeah.
We are tackling a question that feels almost, I don't know, forbidden to ask out loud.
It really does.
But it is a recurring question that I know you listening to this right now have probably thought about.
Yeah.
And that is, why do wars persist and even escalate when the vast majority of human beings living on this planet simply do not want war?
It's the ultimate paradox.
It is. And to answer this, we are digging into an incredibly dense but absolutely paradigm-shifting 2026 academic white paper
Yeah.
by Dr. Bechara-Sirley.
Yeah, the title is From Ungrieved Trauma to Globalized Insecurity.
Right. But before we even take our first step into this material, I really need to set the ground rules for our conversation today because it is vital that we are all on the same exact page.
Yeah, this is crucial.
This source material tackles highly sensitive, deeply politically charged topics. It dives straight into the most painful conflicts of our time, particularly the Middle East. And our role today, as your guides through this material, is absolutely not to take a political side.
No, not at all.
We are not here to endorse a specific nation's viewpoint. And we are certainly not here to act as a judge assigning historical blame.
That is a critical boundary for us to maintain. Our goal here is strictly analytical.
Right.
We are going to impartially map out the fascinating structural arguments that Dr. Sarili presents. I mean, we are looking at the architecture of human conflict through his specific systemic
Are
lens.
dissecting the machine.
Exactly. We
Yeah.
are dissecting the machine, not cheering for any of its moving parts.
I'm really glad we laid that out because the promise of this paper, the real underlying aha moment that we're going to build towards over the next hour or so, is this revelation that war is not just an event.
It's not a glitch.
Right. It's not simply a tragic thing that happens because two world leaders got angry at a negotiating table. War, according to this text, is a self-reproducing system.
It's highly functional.
Yeah, a highly functional machine fueled by hidden layers of institutional power, global finance, and perhaps most surprisingly, our own unhealed human grief.
That last part is heavy.
It's so heavy. So, okay, let's unpack this. If we are looking at a machine, where do we even begin to find the blueprint?
Well, to understand why the world feels perpetually insecure, the paper argues that we first have to look at the very institutions that humanity built to protect us.
Okay.
The foundational concept in Dr. Saheli's white paper is this sociological term called institutional autopoietization.
Okay, institutional autopoietization. That is a massive, highly academic mouthful of a phrase.
It really is.
Let's make sure we ground that in reality so it doesn't just, you know, wash over everyone listening.
Yeah, it sounds intimidating, but the underlying concept is actually quite intuitive. So autopoiesis is originally a term from biology.
Like cells, right?
Exactly. It refers to a system that is capable of reproducing and maintaining itself. A biological cell is autopoietic. But in the sociological context, institutional autopoietization happens when a human institution slowly and often imperceptibly shifts away from its original founding purpose.
And that original purpose is usually something good, right?
Yes. Usually to serve life or to serve a community of people. But over time, the institution adopts a pathological new purpose.
Which is what?
Preserving itself as a system at all costs.
Okay, I was actually reading this section of the paper, and I was trying to think of an everyday analogy to explain this shift, something relatable.
What did you come up with?
Well, the best one I could think of, which I think anyone who's ever lived in a suburb will immediately understand, is a neighborhood homeowners association. And HOA.
Oh, that is actually a brilliant microscale example. Walk us through how that maps onto the theory.
Okay, so think about the life cycle of an HOA. It almost always starts with incredibly good life-serving intentions.
Right, neighbors getting together.
Yeah, a group of neighbors gets together and says, hey, we want to keep this community safe. Let's pool our money so we can fix the potholes on our street, maybe maintain that nice community park so our kids have a place to play.
Just making the neighborhood livable.
Exactly, just keeping it a pleasant place to live. In its founding moment, it is an institution built entirely to serve the life of the neighborhood. But fast forward 10 or 15 years, what happens?
The shift.
The shift. Slowly, the institution autopoietizes. Suddenly, the HOA board doesn't seem to care about the kids playing in the park anymore. They care entirely about their own authority and the preservation of their rule book.
They're the ones measuring grass.
Yes. They're literally hiring people to walk around measuring the length of your grass with a ruler. They're issuing aggressive fines if your trash can is visible from the street for more than 12 hours.
And why do they need those fines?
That's the kicker. They need the money to pay the HOA's retained lawyers to fight the residents who are complaining about the unfair fines.
Right, so the institution no longer serves the neighborhood?
Exactly. The neighborhood now exists merely to serve, fund, and justify the existence of the institution.
That captures the pathology perfectly. You know. The system just becomes this closed loop of self-preservation. And what Dr. Saisley does in this white paper is take that exact pathology that shift from serving the community to consuming the community, and he scales it up.
To what level?
To the level of the modern nation state.
Wow. Okay, so how does that look on a national level?
Well, a healthy state, in this framework, is supposed to act as what the author calls a civil commons. Its fundamental purpose is to protect public health, maintain vital infrastructure, defend human rights.
Just ensure the basic flourishing of the people.
Right. But an autopoietized state becomes an entirely different beast. It becomes completely consumed by regime survival.
So it's the HOA on steroids.
Exactly. It becomes obsessed with security doctrines, rigid border discipline, and maintaining its own geopolitical power. And in this state, the actual living, breathing people no longer matter.
Except as what?
Except as raw resources to be utilized for the state's survival.
And this is where the paper brings up a really famous concept from political science, right? Max Weber's idea about this state having a monopoly on violence.
Yes, Weber's definition from 1919, it's the bedrock of modern political science. He basically defined the state as the only entity that can claim a monopoly on the legitimate use of physical force within a given territory.
So if you or I use violence, it's a crime.
Right. But if the state uses it, it's law enforcement or national defense.
Makes sense.
But what is so fascinating and frankly chilling is the darker twist that Dr. Saisley introduces to Weber's concept here.
Yeah, what's his twist?
He argues that when a state becomes fully autopoietized, it doesn't just claim a monopoly on legitimate force, it claims a monopoly on legitimate sacrifice.
Wait, a monopoly on legitimate sacrifice? Meaning the state is the only entity on earth that is legally and morally permitted to look at you and tell you that you must die for it.
Exactly the distinction. When a state is still healthy and life coherent, any sacrifice asked of the public is heavily constrained.
Like it's debated in Congress or Parliament.
Yes, it's debated through public reason, it's restricted by law, and it's only ever invoked as an absolute last resort to protect actual human lives. But when the state becomes this autopoietized, self-preserving machine, sacrifice fundamentally changes.
How so?
It becomes a sacrament to the state itself. The paper actually outlines a process it calls the conversion chain.
The conversion chain, right.
Yeah, which explains exactly how the state manages to take human beings and turn them into fuel for its own survival without triggering massive public revolts.
Okay, I really want us to go through that conversion chain step by step, because this was one of the parts of the paper that genuinely stopped me in my tracks when I was reading it.
It's very systemic.
It is. It reveals the invisible psychological process of how war becomes possible. So it starts with just a person. Right? A living, breathing human being with a family and a pulse.
Yes. The baseline is a human being. But the first step in the conversion chain is when the state redefines that person as a citizen.
Which sounds completely normal to us. I mean, we all carry passports or ID cards. We're citizens.
It does sound benign. But structurally, it is the crucial first step of abstraction. By labeling you a citizen, the state overlays a legal category onto your biological life.
So you're not just a person anymore.
Right. You are no longer just a human. You are a node in the state's network, and you now owe duties to that state.
Duties up to and including military service.
Exactly. And the next link in the chain is when the state converts the citizen into a soldier.
So the person is removed from their community.
Stripped of their individuality, put into a uniform, and trained to obey orders that completely override their own survival instincts. But it doesn't even stop there.
No.
No. The soldier is then further abstracted by military doctrine into a unit or a strategic asset.
Wow. And this conversion chain doesn't just apply to the military, does it? Because the paper makes it clear that it happens to civilians, too.
It absolutely does. A family living in their home is no longer viewed as a family. Through the lens of the autopoietized state, they are converted into a population.
A population?
Right. Their vibrant neighborhood, full of schools and bakeries, is redefined on a map as a strategic buffer zone or a demographic variable.
So you have all these layers of abstraction. Person to citizen, citizen to soldier, soldier to unit, family to population, neighborhood to buffer zone. And then what happens at the very end of this chain?
At the very end of this chain, when the institution feels its survival is threatened, human beings, both the soldiers it deploys and the civilians in the crossfire, are reduced to what Dr. Sukhely explicitly terms cannon fodder.
Cannon fodder, that's bleak.
They become entirely disposable substrates. The system literally consumes human life to ensure its own institutional longevity.
And the really insidious part, to me at least, is how the state covers its tracks.
Yeah.
The text points out that the state elevates these grand sweeping terms.
Oh, the rhetoric is key.
Yeah. Phrases like national survival or territorial integrity or historical destiny. And it uses those terms as a psychological shield.
To justify the sacrifice.
Exactly. It hides behind those phrases to protect itself from the sheer moral horror of what it's actually doing to soft human bodies.
It's a very effective shield.
So, okay, we have established this terrifying machine, this self-preserving, sacrificial institution. But as we know, a machine cannot run on nothing.
Right, it needs power.
Every machine requires a power source. It needs fuel. And the transition the paper makes here is just incredible because it bridges the gap between cold institutional mechanics and raw human emotion.
This is where it gets deeply psychological.
Yeah, because if these institutions are self-preserving machines, what fuel do they actually run on? The source argues that they run on our deepest, most agonizing, unhealed wounds.
This is a profound shift in the paper's argument.
Right.
We move from the sterile mechanics of state power to the deep psychology of the public.
Ungrieved trauma.
Yes. Dr. Sukhely dedicates a massive portion of this text to detailing what he calls the globalization of ungrieved insecurity.
Okay. Break that down for us.
The core insight here is about collective trauma. When a community experiences a massive trauma, and that trauma is denied or ignored or left completely unrepaired by the wider world, it doesn't just evaporate.
Time doesn't just heal it.
No, time does not heal structural trauma. Instead, that ungrieved trauma becomes politically available.
Politically available.
Yes, it becomes a raw, highly combustible resource that an autopoietized state can actively tap into and exploit.
It essentially weaponizes our sadness.
That is a very accurate way to put it. This isn't just a matter of individual people needing therapy, you know. It is a profound structural issue.
Right.
When collective grief is not allowed to be acknowledged as truth, when there is no truth and reconciliation, no accountability, no material repair, that grief begins to curdle.
It ferments.
Exactly. It ferments into a deep existential fear. And from a political standpoint, fear is incredibly easy to organize.
So easy. The paper actually lays this out in a very specific structural framework. It's a 7-step tragic cycle. And I really want us to take our time and walk through exactly how this mechanism works.
We should, because it's everywhere.
Once you understand these seven steps, you really will start seeing them everywhere in the world. So let's use a historical example from the text to ground this. The paper explicitly points to the United States and the trauma of September 11th.
A very clear example.
Yeah. So let's run that through the cycle. Step one is the starting point, ungrieved trauma. A community experiences a profound, shocking pain. On 9/11, there was a visceral, horrifying loss of life that absolutely shattered the American sense of safety.
Right. Which leads directly into step two in the cycle, which is fear.
The fermentation you talked about.
Yes, because the trauma was so massive and the sense of vulnerability was so unprecedented for the modern U.S. mainland that unprocessed shock fermented into a pervasive dread. The state formalized this fear, too.
Oh, like the terror alert levels.
Exactly. Think back to the color-coded terror alert systems. The entire population was placed into a baseline state of hypervigilance.
Oh, yeah. Which leads to step three, projection. Because, I mean, the inner pain and fear are too overwhelming to just hold on to internally, right?
You can't just sit with it.
No. So they are displaced outward onto others. The fear needs a shape.
And that transitions directly into step four, enemy construction. This is where the autopoietized state steps in and officially labels the quote-unquote other as an existential threat.
So in this example, the fear was projected globally, particularly onto the Middle East.
Yes. The language shifted. Whole populations were suddenly viewed with suspicion. The enemy was constructed not just as the specific individuals who committed the act, but as a broad, shadowy, civilizational threat that justified massive opposition.
And once the enemy is constructed, you hit step five, militarization. The state mobilizes its resources. It passes sweeping new laws like the Patriot Act.
It launches a global war on terror.
Yeah, it creates new surveillance apparatuses and shifts billions of dollars into weapons manufacturing to control this newly constructed enemy.
And that mobilization inevitably leads to step six, harm, because militarization is never just theoretical. It results in physical violence.
Right. In this example, it led to the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. Hundreds of thousands of lives were disrupted or lost. Infrastructure was shattered.
Entire regional ecologies were degraded.
And finally, the cycle concludes with step seven, new trauma. The violence inflicted during the harm phase creates a brand new wound in a new population.
Yes. The civilian casualties and the destabilization in the Middle East created immense new grief.
And because that grief will likely go unseen and ungrieved by the people who caused it, the cycle snaps back to step one.
And it starts all over again.
It's a perpetual motion machine of human suffering.
It is entirely self-sustaining. And the text provides several incredibly diverse historical examples to prove that this isn't about one specific culture or country. This is a universal human pattern.
What other examples does the paper use?
Well, for instance, it also examines Iran. It maps out how the memories of the 1953 foreign-backed coup, you know, which overthrew a democratically elected prime minister, combined with decades of punishing economic sanctions and geopolitical isolation, well, they function as a deep collective trauma.
So that historical wound fuels their fear.
Exactly. It fuels a profound sense of insecurity, which then shapes Iran's highly militarized, defensive, and often proxy-driven regional posture today.
And of course, the text applies this seven-step cycle to the deeply intertwined, incredibly painful traumas of the Middle East, specifically regarding Israel and Palestine.
It does.
And the paper addresses this with profound care, and we need to mirror that exact care here. It discusses the profound, undeniable, civilizational wound of the Holocaust.
Yes.
It looks at how that historical catastrophe, following centuries of systemic persecution, created an entirely understandable, deeply rational fear of annihilation for the Jewish people. It is a trauma of almost unimaginable scale.
It is.
But the paper places that right alongside the trauma of the Palestinian people. It looks at the unresolved dispossession, the ongoing statelessness, and the fragmentation of the Nakba.
What I found so powerful about Dr. Sahili's analysis here is that he is absolutely emphatic that none of these griefs cancel each other out.
Right. It's not a zero-sum game.
Exactly. Acknowledging the pain of the Nakba does not diminish the horror of the Holocaust and vice versa. All the grief is real. The immense danger, the paper argues, occurs when that very real, very human grief is captured by an autopoietized political institution and fed into that seven-step cycle.
Right. But hold on. I need to pause this here and just push back on this framework for a second.
Okay, go ahead.
Because I think a lot of people listening to this might be having the exact same thought I had when I first read this section. If we look at the real world, isn't fear sometimes entirely justified?
Of course it is.
Right. I mean, if a threat is real, if there are actual missiles being fired at your city, or real militant groups planning attacks against your citizens, isn't militarization just basic rational common sense? You can't just, you know, grieve away an incoming rocket.
No, you certainly can't.
You have to defend yourself. So how does the paper address the reality of actual physical threats?
That is a vital pushback, and it is a question the paper actually anticipates. The text absolutely does not deny the reality of physical threats. Dr. Saley states explicitly that terrorism, state massacres, and military occupations are undeniable, horrific realities.
So he's not a pure pacifist saying defense is wrong.
No, no one is suggesting that a state shouldn't defend its people from violence. However, this is where the paper introduces a concept it calls the autopoietic trap.
The autopoietic trap.
Yes, you have a fundamental right to security, but we have to look at the mechanism of that security.
The how.
Exactly, the how. The paper argues that security measures are not what it calls life coherent if the very act of securing yourself actively produces the next generation of threats.
Let me make sure I understand the mechanism here. It's like drinking salt water to quench your thirst.
That's a great analogy.
It feels like a solution in the moment, but it's actually accelerating your dehydration. So if your chosen method of national self-defense involves, say, implementing massive invasive surveillance over a whole population.
Or using collective punishment.
Right, where you destroy a whole neighborhood to get one person. Or implementing policies that deeply humiliate a neighboring community on a daily basis. You might successfully stop a threat today.
Yes, tactically it might work today.
But the mechanism of your defense is literally manufacturing the grievances that will recruit the teenagers who will attack you a decade from now.
That is exactly the autopoietic trap. You are inadvertently feeding the seven-step cycle. And here's where it gets really dark. The autopoietized institution actually benefits from this trap.
Wait, how does it benefit?
Well, the security apparatus goes to the public and says, look, the threats against us are increasing. We need more executive power. We need bigger defense budgets. We need more weapons. And we need less oversight.
And the public agrees because they're scared.
Exactly. And the terrifying truth is the security apparatus is technically right. The threats are increasing, but they are increasing precisely because the institution's own heavy-handed, life-blind methods are generating them.
Oh, wow. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
It ensures the military-industrial complex and the security apparatus never, ever go out of business.
It's a perfect closed loop of systemic violence. Okay, so now we understand why the machine runs. It runs on the potent, endless fuel of ungrieved trauma. But now we need to look at how it operates on a daily basis before a single shot is ever fired.
Right, the day-to-day operations.
And to illustrate this, the source uses an incredibly powerful visual metaphor that I think we can all picture, an iceberg.
The iceberg of violence. It is a concept that builds on decades of work by peace researchers, actually, and it is designed to show the vast difference between visible violence and invisible violence.
Because when we think of war, our minds immediately jump to the visible tip of the iceberg, right?
The kinetic stuff.
Yeah, we think of the things that make the evening news broadcasts. The bombs dropping, the drone strikes, the hostage taking, the tanks rolling down streets, the loud, explosive kinetic violence.
But the paper argues that this visible tip is only a tiny fraction of the whole. Underneath the waterline, hidden from daily view, there are massive submerged structures of invisible violence that are holding up that visible tip.
And Dr. Sully breaks these submerged layers down into two categories, right?
Yes. Structural violence and cultural violence. Let's examine structural violence first.
Okay, what is structural violence?
This refers to the harm that is built directly into the very blueprints of how our global systems are organized. It is not an event, it is a condition. It is the violence of predatory global debt, of crushing economic sanctions, of forced austerity programs.
It's financial violence.
Yes, structural violence quietly weakens what the author beautifully calls the field of life. Think of it this way. Long before a military jet drops a physical bomb on a hospital in a developing nation, that hospital might have already been functionally destroyed.
Because they can't afford medicine.
Exactly. Because the country it resides in is being crushed by the weight of international debt, preventing them from buying basic medical supplies or paying their doctors.
The statistic the paper uses to illustrate this is just staggering. It references a 2024 report from UNCTAD, which is the UN Trade and Development Body.
Right.
The report stated that in a single year, developing countries paid out $921 billion in net interest.
Almost $1 trillion.
Just let that number sit for a second. Nearly $1 trillion. And that isn't even paying down the principal of their loans. That is just the interest.
It's a massive extraction of wealth.
Imagine what that looks like on the ground.
Yeah.
That is money bleeding directly out of vulnerable communities. It is money siphoned away from building clean water facilities, away from hiring doctors for rural clinics, away from building schools.
And that invisible financial transfer is a form of violence because it directly results in preventable human death and suffering.
And that systemic economic leverage is not accidental, is it? It is a profound form of control. You mentioned John Perkins' famous book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, earlier.
Yes, the paper explicitly references it as a recognizable grammar for this kind of institutional capture.
Yeah, for those who haven't read it, the framework is basically that massive international infrastructure loans, these big modernization projects pushed by global financial institutions, are often intentionally designed to be unpayable.
Designed to fail.
Right. They're designed to create inescapable debt burdens. And once a developing country is trapped by that debt, external powers have total leverage over them. They control their natural resources, their UN votes, their domestic policies. It's a way of enforcing discipline through debt.
And operating right alongside that debt discipline, you have the weaponization of broad economic sanctions. Dr. Safia Ali is fiercely critical of how sanctions are routinely lauded by politicians as a nonviolent, civilized alternative to going to war.
Which on the surface sounds great. Mm-hmm. A politician gets on a podium and says, well, we aren't deploying troops, we aren't dropping bombs, we are merely applying targeted economic pressure to bring a rogue regime to the negotiating table.
It sounds so clean.
It does. It sounds like the peaceful option.
But the reality on the ground, beneath the waterline of the iceberg, is entirely different and deeply lethal. The paper argues that broad sanctions act as life support interventions in reverse.
That's a haunting phrase.
Under the guise of peaceful diplomatic pressure, sanctions quietly disable civilian medicine. They collapse fragile food distribution networks. They shut down municipal water purification plants because the country is blocked from importing simple spare parts for the machinery.
So people just get sick and die silently.
Yes. The violence isn't explosive, so it doesn't make the evening news, but it is devastating. It slowly, systematically strangles the civilian population. The stated goal is to pressure the leadership, but autoprioritized leaders rarely miss a meal.
No, they're perfectly fine.
It is always the ordinary, vulnerable people who absorb the harm of structural violence.
Okay, so you have this massive layer of structural violence constantly starving the field of life. But the paper points out a grim reality. To keep this machine running, to actually allow the visible violence at the tip of the iceberg to happen without your own society revolting in absolute moral horror, you need a second submerged layer.
Yes, you need cultural violence.
Cultural violence. Okay, unpack that.
Cultural violence is fundamentally the production of ungrievable people. Before an autopoietized state can bomb a population or occupy their land or sanction them into starvation, that population must first be symbolically removed from the human family.
So this is all about language, media, and perception. The paper calls it a linguistic moral solvent.
A linguistic moral solvent, exactly. It is the intentional use of language to dissolve our natural human empathy.
Think about the news alerts that pop on your phone. Think about the vocabulary we hear every single day on cable news. Words we have absorbed so completely that we barely even register them anymore.
Right.
Words like collateral damage or demographic threat.
Military age male.
Security zone. When a news anchor looks into the camera and says, a localized strike neutralized a high-value target in a security zone with minimal collateral damage. What are they actually saying?
They are talking about human beings being blown apart.
Yes. They are talking about people dying in their own neighborhoods. They are talking about families. But the language sterilizes the blood. It makes the horror sound like a routine municipal accounting error.
That sterilization is the exact function of cultural violence. It converts a profound moral horror into a bland administrative category. If a news report says a teenager was killed, your natural human instinct is to grieve for that child and their parents.
Of course.
But if the state and the media label that same teenager a military-age male, the psychological reaction shifts. His death suddenly doesn't require mourning. It is framed as a statistical, almost preventative outcome of a necessary security operation.
The language preemptively strips him of his innocence.
Exactly.
There is a quote from the text in this section that is just haunting, and I think it sums up this entire mechanism perfectly. The author writes, "Our dead are named, theirs are counted."
It is a devastating summary. Think about the disparity in how we consume tragedy. When members of an autopoietized state's own in-group die, the media ecosystem mobilizes to humanize them.
They show their smiling faces on screen.
Yes. They tell their love stories. They interview their weeping parents. Their innocence is presented as absolute, and their loss is a tragedy that demands justice.
But when people from the enemy population die,
they are merely a number on a scrolling ticker at the bottom of the screen. Or worse, the narrative subtly implies that they were somehow complicit in their own deaths, that they were somehow embedded with the threat, or that they simply shouldn't have been living where they were living.
Wow.
The paper makes a brilliant point here. If a society cannot look at the grief of a mother from the other side without feeling like they're somehow betraying their own country, that society has been entirely captured by the war system.
So we have this massive interlocking architecture of invisible violence happening all around us. Financial strangulation on one side, linguistic dehumanization on the other. And it actually raises a massive question.
Why doesn't the public stop it?
Exactly. If this is happening, why is there no accountability? And the paper says it's because the system has a built-in defense mechanism, a shield that separates the suffering of the victims from the understanding of the public.
The ultimate shield of autopoietic power is secrecy.
Now, let's be realistic for a second. Obviously, some level of state secrecy is necessary in the real world. A country can't just publish the engineering blueprints to its nuclear power grid on the internet, right?
Yeah.
And a diplomat can't broadcast their secret negotiating strategies on live television.
No, and the paper's not naive. It acknowledges that. Time-bound, strictly accountable secrecy can be a functional necessity for a state. But the pathology begins when secrecy stops protecting the public from danger and starts protecting institutional power from the public.
Ah, that's the pivot.
What is so illuminating here is how Dr. Sakely defines the true systemic danger of secrecy. He argues that it severs the feedback loop of life correction.
Life correction. Okay, explain the mechanism of that feedback loop.
Well, in a healthy, life-coherent system, if a government policy causes harm to people, there is a natural feedback loop. The people who are hurt protest, investigative journalists report on the suffering, the voting public gets angry, and the decision makers are eventually forced to correct their course.
So the system learns from the pain it caused.
Exactly. But state secrecy entirely severs that loop. If a covert drone strike wipes out a family, or a classified financial sanction destroys a community's economy, those victims literally cannot provide feedback to the classified intelligence committee that authorized the action.
Because the public doesn't even know what happened.
Exactly, so they can't protest. The decision maker is insulated by classification. They never have to look the consequence of their actions in the eye, which means the system never learns to stop causing harm.
To ground this in history, the paper cites a famous speech by President John F. Kennedy. In 1961, JFK gave an address to the press where he explicitly warned about the grave, inherent dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts by the government.
He saw the danger even back then.
Yeah, even at the height of the Cold War, he saw that a society that normalizes secret, unaccountable power is a society in danger of losing its democratic soul. But this brings up a really critical question, and I want to put this to you directly.
Okay, what is it?
If we start doing an entire deep dive talking about hidden intelligence agencies, covert operations, financial manipulation by global elites, and secret diplomatic bargains, how do we keep this conversation from sounding like a late-night paranoid conspiracy theory?
It is the most important trap to avoid in this kind of systemic analysis. Because a wounded, distrustful public, when they realize they are being lied to, can very easily fall into the trap of scapegoating and paranoid militing if they don't tether their suspicions to rigorous evidence.
Yep.
Dr. Sefili addresses this directly by introducing a concept he calls disciplined unveiling. And to help us practice disciplined unveiling, he provides a tool called the evidence ladder.
The evidence ladder. I found this to be a brilliant, highly practical tool for media literacy. Honestly, everyone should use this when they read the news. It consists of three rungs. Let's break them down.
Okay, the first rung, the highest level of proof, is documented. This isn't speculation. It is absolute historical fact. These are declassified government documents, official international court rulings, or sworn parliamentary inquiries. It's
undeniable stuff.
Right. For example, the paper cites the famous Church Committee hearings in the U.S. in the 1970s, which extensively documented massive illegal abuses by U.S. intelligence agencies.
Or like the 1953 coup in Iran we mentioned earlier.
Yes, exactly. It points to the declassified CIA and MI6 records that explicitly prove the U.S. and British governments orchestrated the overthrow of the Iranian prime minister. It is not a conspiracy theory if you can read it in the government's own declassified archives.
Right. Rung one is undeniable reality. Then we step down to rung two. Credibly allege this is the space of serious investigative journalism.
Yes.
You might not have the smoking gun classified memo yet, but you have multiple serious independent sources all converging on the exact same story. You have credible whistleblowers, forensic data, and partial evidence that all point clearly in one direction.
It requires trust in journalistic institutions, but it is rooted in verifiable data.
And the third rung is analytical inference.
This is perhaps the most crucial for understanding modern autopoietic systems. This is where you look at structural patterns and profit incentives.
Because you don't always have the emails.
Right. You might not have the secret emails between a massive defense contractor and a committee of politicians. But when you look at the observable outcomes, when you track who consistently profits financially from a protracted war, or how institutions reliably behave in ways that mysteriously expand their budgets and executive power, you can confidently infer the systemic drivers at play.
The key takeaway here, and I absolutely love how the paper frames this distinction, is that a conspiracy theory seeks a scapegoat.
Yes, exactly.
A conspiracy theory wants a cartoonish, shadowy cabal of five evil guys sitting in a smoke-filled room controlling the world. It's actually a comforting thought, in a weird way, because it implies that if you just get rid of those five guys, the world is fixed.
Right. It simplifies a complex world.
But a life-coherent systems analysis seeks a structure.
Right.
It understands that there is no smoke-filled room. It's actually much more mundane and much more frightening. It's many different massive institutions, the media conglomerates, the global finance sector, the military-industrial complex, all operating in their own rational self-interest, converging organically to create this life-blind, destructive machine.
Exactly. You do not need a cartoon villain if the structural incentives of the system itself are naturally designed to abstract, exploit, and destroy human life for their own bureaucratic maintenance.
Okay. We have laid out the entire theoretical framework. We have the trauma, the structural violence, the cultural violence, and the secrecy. To show us how all these layers fuse together in the real world, in real time, the author turns his focus to what he calls the escalation ecology of the Middle East.
It is the burning case study of the paper.
And as we step into this specific analysis, I want to reiterate the boundary we set at the very beginning. We're looking at this strictly 100% through the lens of Dr. Saley's systems analysis.
The author's stated methodology for this section is to absolutely refuse selective humanity.
Meaning he maintains total neutrality regarding the inherent value of human life. Every life is equally sacred in this framework.
That neutrality is vital. The paper examines how the conflict in Israel and Palestine is the tragic centerpiece of this framework because it represents a catastrophic collision of two profound unresolved traumas.
We touched on this briefly, but it really requires deeper exploration. On one side, you have the profound Jewish experience of centuries of systemic global persecution, culminating in the unimaginable horror of the Holocaust.
Yes. And this historical reality leads directly to the formation of a state identity that is deeply and understandably hyper-focused on providing absolute refuge.
It relies on overwhelming military deterrence.
Because it carries a historically justified existential fear of annihilation.
And locked in that exact same tiny geography, you have the lived experience of the Palestinian people. The unresolved trauma of the 1948 Nakba, the mass dispossession of homes and land, the decades of ongoing military occupation, and the profound fragmentation of their society.
The tragic thesis of the paper here is that each side's trauma is entirely real, but the autopoietized systems on both sides utilize that trauma to justify military and political actions that perfectly confirm the absolute worst fears of the other side.
It's a locked cycle of mutual triggering.
And the paper doesn't just stay in the realm of psychology. It points to specific, observable examples of structural harm. Regarding the West Bank, it details the continuous expansion of settlements.
And to anchor this in the evidence ladder we just talked about, it cites the International Court of Justice's 2024 advisory opinion and UN Security Council Resolution 2334.
Yes. The text argues that these settlement policies are not just security measures, but actions that convert a temporary military occupation into a permanent structural demographic project, fundamentally altering the field of life.
When the text turns to Gaza, the language is just devastating. It describes the situation there as a catastrophic compression of life.
A total life support crisis.
You have a long-standing blockade. You have internal governance failures. You have the deep militarization of civilian spaces by Hamas. And you have massive, overwhelming Israeli military operations. All of these factors combine to push the basic viability of human life below the threshold of survival.
The paper makes a strict systemic argument here. Any security doctrine that treats a place like Gaza merely as a threat container to be managed through violence, rather than a society of living, breathing human beings, is mathematically guaranteed to reproduce violence.
And the author also brings in the complex layer of Lebanon to show how regional autopoiesis works, right?
Yes. Lebanon is frequently treated as proxy terrain by larger external powers. Its own sovereignty is constantly compromised. The paper references UN Resolution 1701 as a theoretical path to what it calls a life-coherent security compact for the region.
But the reality on the ground is different.
Right. It details how internal sectarianism, the legacy of civil war, and the heavy presence of non-state armed forces keep the entire society destabilized and vulnerable.
Now, navigating all of this pain and conflict requires incredible moral clarity. And the paper introduces a philosophical concept here that I think is one of the most important takeaways of the entire document.
Yeah.
It's about how we judge these different actors.
Yes.
The author demands that we reject false equivalence while strictly holding on to what he calls equal non-disposability. I want to make sure we explain this perfectly. Rejecting false equivalence means we don't just flatten the reality of power dynamics, right?
Correct. A life-coherent analysis requires us to look at reality clearly. The paper states that military occupation is not the same thing as resistance. A state with an advanced, nuclear-armed military is not the same as a stateless population.
State bombardment using precision jets is not the same as a militia firing unguided rockets.
Exactly. There is an asymmetrical responsibility that inherently comes with asymmetrical power.
But, and this is the massive, non-negotiable but of the paper, that asymmetrical responsibility does absolutely not negate the principle of equal non-disposability.
No, it doesn't.
Let me use an analogy here to make this clear. Think of an emergency room in a hospital. When the doctors are doing triage, the concept of equal non-disposability is at work. The doctor doesn't look at two bleeding patients and ask who is richer, who has more historical grievances, or even who started the bar fight that put them there.
They just treat the bleeding.
Exactly. Life is treated as equally non-disposable, regardless of the backstory. Applied to geopolitics, the paper is saying. No matter what the power imbalance is, no matter how deep your historical grievance runs, absolutely no civilian population can ever be made expendable.
No group gets a moral free pass to treat children as collateral damage.
That is the crux of it. You cannot claim that your historical suffering, no matter how profound, grants you the moral authority to make another group of people ungrievable. It is the hardest, most fiercely demanding moral standard a society can hold itself to. But Dr. Salehli argues it is the only standard that can actually break the autopoietic cycle.
Up to this point, the diagnosis we've read is incredibly bleak.
It is so bleak.
We are looking at a global system that is explicitly built to protect its own institutional power at the direct expense of human life. But the author does not leave us in despair.
No, he doesn't.
If the core problem is that the system is built to protect the institution, the logical solution must be to force institutions to empirically prove that they protect life.
This brings us to the prescriptive half of the paper, centered around the life coherence criterion. This is the ultimate standard by which any future geopolitical or security action must be judged.
Yes.
The criterion is stated simply. No institution may claim legitimacy if its survival depends on making living communities disposable. So, what does this all mean? How do you actually apply that to the messy, complicated world of foreign policy and military strategy?
Right. Philosophy isn't enough on its own.
Exactly. To answer this, Dr. Salehli offers 10 specific correctives. These are rigorous tests that decision makers must pass before they take action. Let's actually go through all 10 of these, because I think skipping any of them does a deep disservice to the complete framework the author has built.
I agree. Let's look at how a life-coherent system would actually operate. The first test is the minimum harm test.
Okay, what does that involve?
This completely flips the traditional script on military and strategic planning. Instead of generals asking, how do we most effectively destroy this target, the minimum harm test requires them to ask. who is made more vulnerable by this decision? Have all less harmful diplomatic alternatives been genuinely exhausted?
And is the harm we are about to cause reversible?
Exactly. If an institution cannot clearly answer those questions, the action isn't defined as security. It is defined as naked violence.
Wow. Okay, the second corrective is the mutual survivability test. This asks a deeply profound question. Can the security of one group of people be achieved without relying on the permanent domination, humiliation, or fear of another group?
That is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of nations.
It is. Because if your version of security inherently relies on keeping your neighbor permanently subjugated behind a wall or under an economic blockade, it is not actually security. As the text brilliantly puts it, it is simply deferred war.
You are just delaying the inevitable explosion to a later date.
Exactly. The third corrective is repair before reconciliation.
This is a critical critique of how the international community handles post-conflict scenarios. Often, after a war, diplomats rush in, hold a summit, and demand that the traumatized populations shake hands and immediately reconcile.
Just move on and be friends.
Right. But the paper argues that demanding psychological reconciliation without providing material repair is just a form of domination disguised with softer language.
You can't look at a community and ask them to forgive while they are still living in the rubble of their bombed out homes.
Or drinking contaminated water. True repair means rebuilding infrastructure, restoring ecological damage, and engaging in honest truth-telling. Only after material repair can genuine psychological reconciliation begin.
That makes so much sense. Okay, the fourth test is the concept of non-humiliating exits. I found this absolutely fascinating because it explains why so many modern conflicts drag on for years, long after everyone knows they are unwinnable.
Yes. Wars persist because leaders, even autopoietized ones, often feel that if they stop fighting or concede, they will face total annihilation, public humiliation, or violent regime collapse.
So they just keep fighting.
The paper argues that a life-coherent peace process must deliberately build diplomatic pathways out of the conflict that preserve basic human dignity for all sides involved. If you back a desperate armed actor into a corner where surrender means their total destruction, they will fight to the very last drop of their citizens' blood.
You have to give them a door to walk through, not a dead end.
Exactly. Building on the need for accountability, the fifth corrective is the transparency test. This ties directly back to our discussion on secrecy.
Opening the feedback loop.
Yes. It mandates that any state action resulting in the loss of human life must be subject to an independent, non-classified review within a strictly defined time frame. It forces the feedback loop of life correction back open.
The sixth is the anti-dehumanization protocol. This is the antidote to cultural violence. It requires institutions to fundamentally reject the linguistic moral solvent.
No more collateral damage.
Right. It demands that state media and official communications cease using sterilizing jargon and instead accurately describe the human cost of their policies.
The seventh corrective is the ecological viability standard. We haven't touched on this much, but modern war is an ecological catastrophe.
Oh, massive. The carbon footprint alone. Not to mention the toxins.
This test dictates that no security measure can be justified if it permanently destroys the life support systems, the water tables, the arable land, the air quality that future generations, regardless of their nationality, will rely on to survive.
The eighth is the absolute rejection of collective punishment. This is a bedrock principle of international law that the autopoietized state constantly tries to blur.
Constantly.
This corrective demands a strict adherence to the idea that you can never, under any circumstances, punish an entire civilian population by cutting off their power, their food, or their movement for the actions of an armed faction operating within their borders.
The ninth corrective targets the structural violence we discussed, structural violence audits. This requires international financial institutions to audit their loans and sanctions not just for economic efficiency, but for their direct impact on human mortality.
So if a debt plan causes starvation.
If a debt restructuring plan or a sanction regime mathematically results in a spike in child malnutrition or preventable disease, it fails the life coherence test and must be dismantled.
And finally, the 10th corrective is the asymmetrical responsibility check. This enforces the triage analogy we used earlier. It ensures that while all life is equally non-disposable, the actors with the most structural power, the most advanced militaries, and the strongest economies bear the heaviest burden of responsibility for finding non-violent solutions and maintaining the field of life.
Implementing these 10 correctives seems like a monumental, almost impossible task for our current political systems.
It really does. It sounds like trying to turn around an aircraft carrier with a paddle.
Passing these tests requires a fundamental civilizational shift in how we process information, how we understand power, and ultimately how we value human beings. It requires a completely new way of knowing.
And that is what Dr. Saikili outlines in the final section of the paper, proposing the creation of a life knowledge commons.
The life knowledge commons. It sounds like a utopian academic concept, but it's actually a highly practical method of reversing the abstraction we've been talking about this whole time.
How does it work?
It is a deliberate civilizational practice designed to train us to look at the world without the sterilizing, life-blind filters of the autopoietic state. If the modern system trains us to abstract life into numbers and threats, the commons is a practice that trains us to return knowledge back to life.
The paper provides a series of beautiful grounding reversals to illustrate how the commons views the world in direct opposition to how the state views it. I love these so much.
Walk us through some of them.
Well, in the autopoietized system, a massive forest is viewed merely as a carbon offset value or a timber resource.
Mm-hmm.
But in the life knowledge commons, a forest is recognized for what it actually is, a complex, living, breathing ecosystem that sustains multiple forms of life.
It's beautiful.
In the system, a sick person in a hospital bed is abstracted into a billing code or a liability. In the commons, that patient is seen as a vulnerable human being actively seeking healing.
That shifts the whole perspective of care.
Right. In the system, a person fleeing a war zone is labeled as migration pressure or a border security crisis. In the commons, a refugee is recognized as a person carrying profound memories, trauma, and undeniable human rights. And most powerfully, in the system, a child from an opposing group is coldly calculated as a future demographic threat.
But in the commons, a child is simply a child.
Exactly. To institutionalize this profound shift in perspective, the commons insists that society must adopt five core commitments.
Yes. First, an unwavering commitment to protect all civilian life, unconditionally.
Unconditionally.
Second, a commitment to name specific individual responsibility for harm, rather than allowing leaders to hide behind vague institutional shields or national flags.
Third, a total rejection of collective guilt.
Fourth, a dedication to continuously exposing hidden power, practicing disciplined unveiling to bring secrecy into the light of accountability.
And fifth, a commitment to actively repair the life support systems of our planet. What this paper is ultimately calling for is a total ground-up redefinition of the word security.
We have to move away from our current model of life-blind security.
A model that relies on military domination, that produces endless enemies through media manipulation, and that views victory purely as the state surviving while its people suffer.
We have to transition to life-coherent security, a model where true security means mutual survivability, where the media operates to widen our empathy instead of narrowing it.
And where the state actually returns to its original purpose.
Serving and protecting the flourishing of human life, rather than demanding that life sacrifice itself to keep the machine running.
It is a massive paradigm shift. It requires moving from a mindset of extraction and domination to one of regeneration and relational interdependence. It demands that we finally recognize a very simple, very difficult truth. On a deeply interconnected planet, we will survive together or we will not survive at all.
That is the core message.
I know this has been an incredibly heavy, dense, deep dive. We have covered the weaponization of trauma, the depths of systemic and cultural violence, and the deepest, darkest flaws in the institutions that govern our world. But I want to take a second to speak directly to you, the person listening to this.
Yeah, bringing it back to the individual.
This framework is heavy, yes, but I truly believe it is fundamentally necessary. It gives you the instruction manual to read the world differently. I want you to take this framework, take these concepts, and apply this lens the very next time you are scrolling past a geopolitical headline or watching the evening news.
It changes how you see everything.
When you see a conflict unfolding, don't just look at the visible tip of the iceberg. Ask yourself the hard questions. Am I seeing a community of human beings being made disposable so that an institution can survive?
Who is financially or politically benefiting from the fear being broadcast right now?
And whose grief is being completely ignored by the language being used?
The moment you begin asking those specific questions, the invisible architecture of power begins to reveal itself. It becomes visible. And visibility is always the very first step toward accountability and change.
And before we go, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over as you go about your day. It's a small detail hidden deep in the architecture of this paper's analysis. The author briefly touches on digital platforms and algorithmic bias as modern forms of submerged digital violence that amplify our fears.
That is a fascinating thread.
I want you to think about the device you might be listening to this on right now. Think about your smartphone. Think about your social media feeds. We spent a lot of time today talking about cultural violence, about how institutions use language to make people ungrievable.
Right.
How often do you think the engagement algorithms in our pockets are secretly acting as the modern engines of that exact cultural violence? Because algorithms feed on outrage and fear. Are they quietly training us, day by day, hour by hour, notification by notification, to view the grief of others as somehow less real, less important than our own?
Are we carrying the very tools of institutional autopietization in our hands?
Voluntarily participating in the narrowing of our own empathy. It is something we all need to be fiercely vigilant about. We have to consciously, actively choose to keep our circle of empathy wide, especially when the machinery of the world profits from making it narrow. Thank you so much for joining us on this incredibly intense but hopefully illuminating deep dive. Keep asking the hard questions, keep looking beneath the waterline for the hidden structures of the world, and keep seeking life-coherent truths. We'll see you next time.